I would like to share with you tonight about the groundless ground. When the Buddha brought forth the teaching on the First Noble Truth, the First Noble Truth being that life is suffering, what he didn't tell us in that truth alone, in most cases, is the teaching that suffering is optional. So how can life be suffering and suffering be optional? Good question. If you know his teachings of the second, third, and fourth noble truth, he answers the question as to how life can be suffering and suffering can be optional. There's a life that's liberated from suffering. But in order to realize that life that's liberated from suffering, us funny creatures, us humans, seem to need suffering to realize we don't need suffering. What we're exploring with each other's help is the possibility of openness in all situations, all emotions and thoughts and sensations and activities. Now, this openness is actually like finding dying before death finds this body. And death is stalking this body. From the moment this body was conceived, death was stalking this body. When I say what we're doing here is finding dying before death or dying finds this body, is I'm talking about the dying of fear. I'm talking about the dying of confusion. I'm talking about the dying of resistance, of grasping. I'm talking about the dying of separation. Now, if I, so to speak, identify myself as that which is grasping, that which is resisting, that which needs to defend, then it makes sense, doesn't it? When those things come up on the, you could say, chopping block, it's going to be dicey. If I'm invested in existing in those forms, as those forms peel off, as they lift and peel off, I'm in trouble. We're finding dying before dying finds this body. So much so that this work, we call it the work of awareness, but I think it might be better tonight to call it the work of love. Now, even while the knee is hurting and the back is aching and the food wasn't quite right and it's still too hot upstairs, and nobody's taking care of that, it seems. And how about a decent banana instead of a whatever banana? A huge energy, if we're not careful, can get employed in defensive, resistive, running away from life strategies. And meanwhile, it's being suggested that this could be the safest, most loving thing we could be doing with ourselves this weekend. Came out in one of the small groups today that, have you noted that when we're sitting here on these relatively cushy cushions, some of us have harder cushions than others, there's no nails coming up through the floor, there's no hot coals under there, and there's nobody hitting you with a stick. So if stuff is coming up that's uncomfortable, doesn't that say something about the possibility that it's actually in there already? That the environment, the cushy carpet, isn't making it happen? There's something about taking care, not as like a burden, but taking care in this, so that that loving, caring awareness or energy really, really works for us. Now, honestly, you don't have to say it out loud because you're not talking. You don't even have to raise your hand. But did anybody even have a slight whisper of wanting to leave at some point between the beginning, Friday morning, and now? Just a little bit of, there might be something interesting or better to do. Maybe just I'll go sit in my car. I mean, I won't let anybody see me sitting there. I'll do it when it's kind of dusk. It got so bad once, you could say, this resistance, this struggle, for the same fellow I was mentioning earlier today, this Joseph Goldstein. Some of you may know of him. Very, very lovely man. Very dedicated. Good teacher. I like him a lot. He said it got so bad one day, he was reading the ingredients on the soap box in the laundry room, just because it was just too much to be with what was happening. Get me out, please. Now, the funny thing about the practice is that as you get into it more and more, even the ingredients on the soapbox are fascinating. Wow. What is that? It becomes luminous. Luminous soap ingredients. That wasn't his experience, though, as he related. He was struggling big time. Huge energy can get employed in defensive, resistive, running away from life strategies. The defensiveness is employed in the name of pseudo-security. Pseudo-security and survival of the sense of separation, oddly enough. Protecting and defending the sense of me as a separate self. As this energy, more or less, begins to shift out of resisting, fighting, and running away from life, this energy becomes the petrol. It's the fuel. Big part of the fuel for the awakening itself. It's so much a part of the awakening itself, the samsara of resisting, that it's been said that the samsara itself is liberation. Now that's pretty difficult for the conceptual mind. It's kind of like saying black is white. No. Black is black and white is white. A little closer to what our conceptual mind can handle. One side of the coin is connected to the other. Okay, yeah, two sides of the same coin. But to say samsara, perpetual wandering, is liberation? Oh, that's a stretch. Those confusing Zen poets sitting around laughing at us as they sip tea in their realization of what they put forth on the page, and then they died. Isn't that what Lao Tzu did? He laid it down and then he walked off into the mist, as the legend has it. Who knows whether it actually happened or not, because none of us were there. But it's a nice legend, isn't it? Disappearing into the mist. What an image. Someone gave me a Zen koan. It's not too difficult, just before the talk. And it went like this. You can lead a fish to water, but you can't make him drink. That's actually a little more deep than I thought it was going to be. Deep in the sense that difficult to comprehend. So this energy of resistance begins to turn around and becomes the fuel. It becomes the fuel so much that sometimes people, this happened today in a small group, reporting, I want to get into the depth. I want to get into the depth of that feeling. I want to feel what's coming. I want to allow it. Yes, this is it. This is life. This is it. I'm in it. Full contact sport. I'm not going to beat around the bush. I am the bush. And that can get very vigorous sometimes. It can get very passionate, alive, vital, courageous. So the conditioned reality that we went into quite a bit last night, or the relative truths of life, yeah, all that which is time-bound, all that which is arising and passing, all that which is impermanent. It's a frictional dynamic play of elements and forces, ever-changing, pleasant, unpleasant, sometimes in between the pleasant and unpleasant, it kind of goes a bit neutral for a while. We get sleepy when the neutral comes, that often happens. We even get bored. Nothing's going on, we just kind of get, neutral feeling. And when people are deep in discomfort, deep in the unpleasantness, do they want a neutral feeling? Give me a neutral feeling, please. Anything but this, it hurts too much. And sometimes even in the pleasurable side, people can't stand it. It just feels too good. And they're dying for something to contract. Because it starts to get scary as it becomes more and more and more expanded. And less and less and less solid. Years ago, I can't remember how many, I guess it was 20 or something like that, I was sitting and been sitting for a while, and this dissolution came. It started at the feet and started moving really fast. It came right up through the body, just completely dissolving. It hit the heart, and then it hit the heart. Boom, fear came. Body solidified again. Apparently. And without even being present to what was happening, I beat it out of that bush, out the back of the meditation hall, down a flight of stairs, down into the corner of a room below, came to my senses in the corner, breathing hard, going, whew, wow, what a ride. I don't know how I got down the stairs. It's in a fugue state, disassociated. going to go into how that is optional and ultimately not necessary to hold back and resist anything. That's really what this talk is about, in other words. So the pleasurable, painful, or pleasurable, unpleasant experience, the expansion, the contraction of life goes on, goes on, goes on, goes on, goes on. That's the nature of the body-mind process. It's been happening from the beginning of it, and it'll happen right up until this thing breathes its last. Expansion, contraction, pleasant, unpleasant, changing, changing, changing. If you believe you are that, then you are subject to that. You are subject to that object. You're under its influence. You're under its spell. You're under its trance. Even just a little bit of equanimity, that's called balance, non-reactivity, arises in relation to the pleasant, unpleasant swing. And there can be a moment of seeing it and not being caught in it. And the energy goes this way and the energy goes that way, and it's okay. There's a sense of okayness, even as it intensifies down and it's hurting more, and there's change happening there too. And it's okay that the pendulum keeps swinging. That's the nature of the pendulum. Trying to stop that would be like trying to stop the wind. So this frictional dynamic play, this is the playground. This is where we have the opportunity to realize that the energy that's there is here to assist. It's ultimately our friend. It's our ally. It's our teacher. So relative ground is clear seeing of conditioned reality. As you see conditioned reality clearly, you become, so to speak, relatively grounded. So relative groundedness, in form, means there's clear seeing of relative reality, which is the frictional dynamic play of elements. As you become open and steady amidst that, you feel a relative groundedness. And this feels pretty good. Okay, it's not a solid thing. It's not what we are. But it feels pretty good. And one feels almost at times, people talk about, ooh, I finally got a handle on this stuff. I'm finally settled. A word like that comes out. We have other ways of getting this relative ground. For example, our life is going on in this way, in this way, in this way, so maybe difficult things are happening work-wise, career-wise, relationship-wise, family-wise, health-wise. And we construct a story in our mind about these things that are happening. And maybe we even speak this to someone else. We hear ourselves say it. They hear us say it. Maybe they're therapeutic and they reflect it back to us. And when we hear that, we go, yeah, that's what's going on. I understand that now. That makes sense to me. I did this, they did that. This happened, then that happened. Had to sell the house. La 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 la. And we feel some relative ground in having constructed that story. We've all done this, yes? You can nod if you want. When feelings or perceived needs or beliefs and even thoughts are identified clearly. You see, oh, there's that thought. Oh, there's that feeling. Oh, there's that perceived need. Oh, there's that perceived belief. When we see those things clearly, that generates a relative ground. And that relative ground feels relatively good. Ah, okay, there. That's clear. That's what I was thinking. That's what I was needing. That's what I was believing. That's what I was remembering. Ah, okay, I see that. We all have this experience. The power of telling the truth to other human beings, particularly if they're caring and interested, that's also very grounding, relatively speaking. And so we see this throughout many different traditions and different psychologies, is lining up with the truth and speaking it and being received by others in some understanding or empathy, grounding effect. Now, we're sitting. Okay, let's go to the sitting now. We're sitting, or we're walking, or we're standing, and the energy begins to organize itself in such a way that we feel a certain kind of vertical alignment. And so for some people, they sit down in the very first sitting of a weekend like this, and they sit, and without even any practice, this happens, or they've been practicing for a while, they feel a certain vertical alignment. You know what I'm talking about? They just kind of, oof. And sometimes it feels like the body's sort of being held up by the energy, and as the breath is coming in and out, it sort of supports this alignment. Okay? So one's kind of a little bit or a lot released from the idea that I'm holding my body up. There's an energy that's moving. And sometimes the energy is moving up, sometimes moving down, sometimes going like this. It can be moving around in different directions. But that verticality feels relatively grounding. If we feel like we're just going up, 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 and we never get a sense of actually settling down, okay, we can actually kind of feel like we're going out and getting ungrounded. This happens to people sometimes. They start to listen to the sounds, and all of a sudden the vastness appears and they get scared. And they pull back, grab their knees or something. But the settled down that comes out of the verticality, okay? It's very interesting because the Sufis said, you know, if you talk about awakening in some kind of a directional path, that's not really what it is, but sometimes it's conceived that way. In the Sufi tradition, they say you got to go down before you go up. Which is really interesting because it means you got to go down into your psychology, you got to go down into your emotional life, you got to go down into your biography, you got to go down into the darkness before you ascend. And this is a view in certain traditions, not really in Buddhist traditions, of the heavens up. The heavens up. I never really felt so good about that. Even though it was pumped into me. It's up. You want to go up, not down. Go up. The Sufis helped me in the sense they said, go down. Find out what's down there. Go down. I remember doing TM for years and it was so sweet. I get so concentrated. I feel so happy. Everything tasted good. Everything looked good. I felt like I loved everybody. I loved myself. And I was in a kind of a trance of concentration. It was nice. I never got to the point where I was like floating. You can do that if you do enough concentration practice. You can actually like feel like you're floating or literally float. People, these TM meditators, that come off the cushion and they're floating. They look very happy. Can you imagine that? All right, everybody, in the next out breath, you're going to float. You know, if it really works, you float with Steve's instructions. There is no body. This sensation. But my instructions take you down into the deep muck. No, hopefully not. Now, telling the truth. Getting your story straight. Vertical alignment. Settled down. These things open to spacious groundedness. What's spacious groundedness? Sense of body sitting, mind is doing whatever it's doing, breath doing whatever it's doing, sensations, and the spaciousness opens. And the body sitting in the spaciousness, relatively grounded. The mind-body process relatively grounded, but spaciousness becomes the object, if you will, of the meditation. And sometimes it happens spontaneously, or people go into the sounds, and they just all of a sudden go out. And it's big and it's wide, and yet there's still a groundedness. And yet within and through all of this that I'm describing, the separate self-construct can still be operating and generating subtle resistance in the form of identification and protectiveness. Now, what did I just say? I said that identification is resistance. The tendency to identify yourself as this or that, or anything, is resistance. And it's protectiveness, subtle as it may be. In fact, if there was no resistance, this is where resistance becomes very handy, if there was no resistance, there would be no separate self-perception. There would be no ego project. And in fact, then there would be no awakening, and there would be no transcendence. That's why we need suffering, to realize we don't need suffering. Master Hakuin. All beings are essentially Buddhas. As with water and ice. There is no ice apart from water. No beings who are not Buddhas. Apart from beings, there are no Buddhas. Not knowing how close to them the truth is, beings seek it afar. What a pity. Master Hakuin is pointing at the groundless ground. I'm going to repeat this teaching. The ultimate groundless ground of being or Buddhahood is not an object. It is not objectifiable. It cannot be defined or confined. It is both no thing and everything. No thing means no thing particular. It's not nothing. No thing and everything. It is nowhere and everywhere simultaneously. It is non-locatable. It is the great space. It is the great intimacy. Now, if this sinks in, even part of it sinks in, the talk can be over for you. Actually, this talk could be over at any moment for you or me. The ultimate groundless ground of being, or Buddhahood, is not an object. It is not objectifiable, therefore it cannot be defined or confined. It is both nothing and everything. It is nowhere and everywhere simultaneously. Non-locatable, it is the great space, the great intimacy. Is it clear that it is not an object? It is not an object like thought is an object, sound is an object, body is an object, feeling is an object, food is an object. What does that mean? It means it's a no thing. It's not a thing. It cannot be defined even though these words are pointing at it. and it cannot be confined. It cannot be defined. That means it has no center. It cannot be confined. That means it has no circumference. These words are pointing nowhere. That's their point. In the openness to the nowhereness or everywhereness of Buddha nature, there can be a taste or remembrance or a scent of it. This rock musician Bono took a shot at it. He said, "Nirvana is like the smell of a newborn baby's head." Problem is, he made it an object. Nice object, though, huh? Pretty neat smell. Non-locatable. You know why? You know why non-locatable? Because we're sitting in it. It's closer than the tip of our nose. It's impossible to conceive. That's not said here. It's another way of saying not objectifiable. It's easier for us to go with, the great space. How about the great intimacy? Master Dogen, Zen Master Dogen said, enlightenment is intimacy with all things. So intimate with all things that there's no separation. That's the great space. Everything is completely touching. So touching that it's not even touching. No seam. The self-construct project, call it the ego project tonight, which actually manifests as the attempt to have fulfillment through acquisition of experiences, through acquisition of things, through acquisition of pseudo-security in the realm of impermanence, the attempt to have fulfillment through objects, I mean fulfillment, real fulfillment, lasting fulfillment. I like the hot sauce at dinner. It was temporarily fulfilling. That's not what I'm talking about now. The ego project that attempts to fulfill through objects and acquisition and ownership, material ownership, through roles, this is who I think I am, this is what I do, I get accolades for this, I get liked, I get loved for this, I get my picture taken, I feel good about myself. Flip side of that is there's always risk that I could not feel good about myself. Somebody could do something just a little bit that disrupts that inflation. Having things go my way. Surviving through the identified self constructs. Attempts at fulfillment, happiness, and real peace. This project is doomed to fail. It's so doomed to fail in that respect that I just described. It's okay that it's here. We'll get to. It was doomed to fail from the get-go. It never got off the ground, even as it appeared to be working. And yet, have you looked at the vitality and the tenaciousness of this repetitive, habitual, self-reinforcing self-construct and projection of who I think I am and what I'm going to do in the name of who I think I am. And we know how uncomfortable it can be when you're with someone who has a big ego and either intentionally is parading it or doesn't even see that that's what's in charge. You know that feeling around that? Because what's hidden inside that is tremendous insecurity. Tremendous insecurity. Tremendous defensiveness. And what is that all about, that self-construct, that ego project? If we're not careful, what it's about is trying to acquire all of that. Meanwhile, unconsciously, he, she, if it's got that to it, is resisting wholeness through its maintenance of its own separateness. It's resisting the great intimacy, the great space. It's claiming itself as separate. And it's deeply threatened by the intimacy or closeness, even at times with another being. So, what to do? In one sense, nothing, but that would not be all that interesting to just leave it there. So, let's identify that there's going to be inherent shakiness and anxiety when there is identification with self-constructions, no matter what they are. You think of yourself as the grounded verticality. You think of yourself as really good at telling the truth. You think of yourself as really good at being able to identify what's going on and describe it to other people and formulate a story that makes sense to you, and they believe you too. Wow, that's great, that makes sense, that's the truth. You got it. There's an inherent shakiness and anxiety there. Why? Because there's no solid foundation under that. There's no foundation in that self-construction. That doesn't mean it's a bad thing. The personality ego project has a place. All I'm talking about is if it's driving the car, that's a problem in terms of awakening. If it must be the center of the stage. And we need, in a way, to be extremely honest to see what is running the show here. What force is driving the car of my life? And if it's somewhat about maintaining the sense of separateness that I'm okay right over here, then there is insecurity for sure underneath that hiding. Maybe unworthiness, undeservedness, need to be loved. And inside and alongside the need to be loved, there's a desire to love. And in that loving, yeah, that's going back and forth, there's some dissolution, isn't there, of some degree of separateness. How come we are urged to merge by parts of our being? What's that all about? It's much more than just sex. Much more. The deepest anxiety is the sense of groundlessness, groundlessness, which at first appears as a sense of lack that motivates compulsive attempts to ground and identify yourself. Let me say that again. The deepest anxiety is the sense of groundlessness, which at first appears as a sense of lack that motivates compulsive activities to ground and identify yourself. This is why when impermanence shows up, some degree of dissolution. It doesn't have to happen like it did with this body. It's different for all of us. That's important to recognize. There's similarities, but it's always different. Actually, awakening is different for all of us. You can find similarities and correlations, but it's unique. It's like our fingerprint. That's why the cops get it. Sometimes it's even better, I guess, than the mugshot to identify. It's unique. Just like the grains of sand on the beaches. Every single grain is unique and different. Now I ask, how did that come to be? That's marvelous. Compulsive activities to ground and identify myself in the face of the safest show in town, which is the intimacy and openness and ultimate groundlessness of being. The existentialists, now the existential philosophers, did some good work. They did some good work at understanding certain components of the existential experience. And one of the things that they identified very clearly was anxiety. They said, anxiety is a core issue for humans. Now, they weren't talking unconditioned experience. They were talking conditioned experience. The anxiety, the uncertainty, the not knowing, you see, this unknown, unless the unknown, yeah, unless the precipice, unless the free fall, becomes the playground rather than the cliff off which you try not to fall. Okay. Until that, then anxiety, a little or a lot, pulls at the spine, it pulls at the base, it pulls at the perineum, it pulls inside here, it pulls in the hands, it pulls, it pulls, it pulls, it pulls, it pulls. Tugs. Ultimately, it's saying, listen to me, listen to me. I'm here to teach you. I'm here to show you. I'm here to reveal for you what you do not yet see. David Loy, Buddhist scholar. Met him once. Bit heady, but he was good. I liked him. He said this. If the separate self is a delusive construct, delusive means delusional, then there is a subtle but critical distinction between fear of death and fear of emptiness. Got that? Let's do it again. You know who said it, right? Doesn't matter. David. If separate self is a delusive construct, which means it's not actually real, delusive, it's deluded, then there is a subtle but critical distinction between the fear of death and the fear of emptiness. Now, the fear of emptiness, or emptiness, is sometimes in other traditions called the void. There's all kinds of things written about the void, all kinds of different practices to deal with the void, open to the void, la la la. It's all pretty much the same thing when you boil it down. You either open into it, you get comfortable with it, or you're resisting it. It's pretty much one or the other. Is this interesting? Okay, good. I hope so. Never know what's going to work here, for sure. If we take ourselves to be the separate self construct, then we're always vulnerable to feeling disconnected. Because the separate self perception is always by definition disconnected, isn't it? It is disconnected in the sense that if I am an object or set of objects, and I perceive myself to be separate from other objects, then what I'm going to perceive is that relationship with other human beings is an exchange of objects to objects. And if that exchange of object to object, which in psychology is called object relations, gets relatively smooth and harmonious, you know, and is fluid, that feels like a good exchange. That's a good relationship. tucked right in that is the perception of separateness. Now, the perception of separateness, you can look in another being's eyes. You don't have to look in their eyes. You can actually look at anything. And if you look at something, and you really look or gaze, the sense of separation can thin right out. You look deeply into another person's eyes sometimes, and you actually see something that looks like you looking back at you. Okay? That's part of the dissolution of the sense of separation, which means those objects, object here, relating to one another, is starting to dissipate and dissolve. That's why we're sometimes afraid to look in other people's eyes and really look there, really see what's there. Because what we might see is the end of separation. Just like if we really open into the sounds and we realize that the sound is both inside and outside simultaneously, then who am I? I'm unbounded for a moment. Notice the perception that you are inside this bag of skin. Very common, very habitual perception. There's the self-construct. I'm inside this. Rich is inside that. Ann's there. Steve over here. We name it. And not only that, there's Steve's body, Paul's body. These are concepts. They're self-constructions. Now, when you see it as a concept, actually, there's no arm. Try this. There's no arm. That's not an arm. Can anybody see this as not an arm? You don't have to raise your hand. Okay, this is not an arm. Now, how many of you go, yes, it is. That's an arm. You feel that place in the mind? That's an arm. No, it's not. This is not an arm. This is not a head. Okay, this is not a blue shirt. It's not a blue shirt. It's not. This is not a leg. This isn't paper. It's not. Okay? That's not wood. Whoops. Oh, this is good. Watch this. Be ready for impermanence. All I'm saying, I mean, I could go on and on and on. I could go through the whole list. Flowers, floor, ceiling, wall, motorcycle. Go through the whole list of words. Those are concepts. We go inside, we begin to feel what's actually here without the concept, and Steve gave it to us this afternoon. It's a field of sensation. Guess what? We can't see it, and we have a hard time believing it, but this is floating particles. Appearing as a solid piece of wood. This isn't just Buddhist metaphysics. It's not metaphysics. This isn't Buddhist psychology. This is science. Now, the difference between thinking that there's another concept and actually experiencing that is critical. That's why we're doing this practice, so that we don't hang around and feel like we understand this stuff because we read books and it makes sense and we talked about it and, yeah, I know what the no-self is and blah, blah, blah. No, you don't. There's nobody who knows what the no-self is. That somebody goes away because that somebody is the self that says there is no self. So to say there's nobody who knows no-self, what I'm basically saying is that in that realization that there is no self, the self-construction falls away and is known by nobody anymore. So basically what's sitting here talking to you is nobody. And you think you're somebody sitting over there, maybe listening to this, and you're somebody listening to this. You're nobody, too. Now, this can get confusing, it can get uncomfortable, it can get unsettling, or it can just be funny. And we start going, oh, really? Oh, it's just a cartoon, we're just goofing around, we're all nobodies. But actually, this is very, very important. It's not just a joke, although it is funny, it's reality. We are not what we think we are. We are what we are. And that's what this whole thing is about, is finding that out. What we are is the groundless ground of being. Okay. This part here is really, really important. If we take ourselves to be the separate self-construct, then we're always vulnerable to feeling disconnected. And because disconnectedness doesn't feel good to the separate self, isn't that ironic? The separate self is always trying to get connected to other separate selves and objects. Now watch this. When you go from trying to get connected to another being who may not be into you as much as you're into them. You ever been there? Okay. It'll still work, Ed. In other words, you want to connect, you want to relate, you want to have understanding, you want it to flow, you want it to feel good, you might even want to go deeper than that, you want to live together, you know where I'm going, okay? And that person's not necessarily there. Sometimes what you do is you leave it and you go outside. Why do you go outside? You go outside because when you feel yourself as an object trying to connect to other objects, when you connect to the objects of nature, those objects of nature, natural world, don't reject you. Trees, they just hang there, and you can go up and you can hug them, and you can go, and you can get on the ground, and you can go, and you can laugh with it, and you can do all this stuff, and it just receives you. That's why the Dharma sometimes is described as the natural world. You can be in misery because another set of objects in a body bag just like yours rejected you, and you can go over and you can lie with your cat and your cat purrs and it gets on your chest and then it curls up and it puts its chin up and it loves you and you go to sleep. And you wake up and you still think you're an object and the cat's separate from you. This is how it goes sometimes. It's okay. It's not like, okay, let's see if we can stop doing that. Okay, try do that. Sometimes people say, I'm gonna try to stop doing all that. You know, I'm gonna fast. I'm gonna meditate. I'm gonna sit still. I'm not gonna move. I'm not gonna be an object. There's an object trying to not be an object. It just doesn't work. It's like the fellow who came on retreat once years ago and he had an agenda. It was a little bit different than what I was offering. And it was a relatively longer retreat than this, about 6 days. And he was very wealthy, and he was very young, and he was good-looking, and his girlfriend came with him. So these are the things that were available to be noticed right up front. And he did separate from her during the retreat, which is important, unless you understand how to be together and not just be... Okay. So they did that, and she seemed more, you know, open to this whole thing than he, in the sense that he was always taking notes, and he was looking at me. And he's looking at others, and he's taking notes. And this went on for, like, imagine that, for 5 days, he's taking notes. And then finally he came to me, and on like the fifth day in the afternoon he came, and he said, "This isn't working for me." And I said, "Do you mind if I ask what you're doing?" And he began to describe what he was doing. And what he was doing was trying to control his whole experience. He was using the meditation in a way where he was trying to move his energy around and have it go this way and have it go up and have it go out and have it go all around everybody else. And I would have, if I knew it at the time, done a Dr. Phil with him, which was basically, "How's that working for you?" But I didn't know Dr. Phil at the time, so I said something kind of akin to that. And basically what happened was he started to deconstruct. He didn't fall apart emotionally, but he started to just, he put his notes down, and I said, just go into your breathing. Try that, okay? Remember that from day one? Remember that? He didn't quite remember that. So we went back to day one. I said, try that breathing, just in and out, try that. And he started doing that. And then he went into the little more of the sensation. He started opening up to that, and his notebook was gone. And the retreat ended, and he came up to me, and he said, thank you. And he said, can I come to your house? He was from California, so I said, okay, that's a little unusual request, but what do you want, if you don't mind me asking? He said, well, he goes, you know, I like you, but that's not really why I want to come to your house. Why I want to come to your house is you must have a lot of books. Whoop, back in his head. You must have a lot of books. I said, well, I do have some books. He said, I want titles. Back out with the notebook. He comes over, he diagnoses my dog's restlessness and tells what, you know, supplements the dog needs, because he's a nutritional dude. He's got all this nutritional stuff going on. And actually what he said to me was kind of like a Zen koan, and I didn't quite understand what he said, and I should have written it down, because it actually sounded like it really was something important that I could give my dog that would help my dog. Of course, I thought my dog was okay before he came, but the diagnosis gave me a different perception, so I thought, well, maybe my dog could be better. Takes his Zen koan supplement of the nutritional dude who was trying to raise his kundalini and go out through the top and embrace all of us with divine love during lunch. And it didn't work out so well, so we came down like the Sufis to ground, and it was very lovely. And that's a separate self construct going haywire. We're always going to be negotiating our existence, our position, our status, our place, if we're identified with that separate self-construct. That's the game. Always got to negotiate it. Got to work on it. Sort it out. Shift it around. So fragile. So ungrounded, ultimately. All you have to do is see just a little bit of impermanence, like, holy smokes. That's a project that was doomed to fail. And something begins to shift. Your heart begins to loosen. Your mind shifts in some way. You don't see yourself or the world quite the same. But everything's still the same as well. Different, yet the same. Okay, now, this could be the most important line in the weekend. Is that a hypnotic suggestion? So if we're only this set of objects, and others are the set of objects that they perceive themselves to be, we're always going to be apprehensive about losing our ground. Which actually means we are going to have fear of loss of disconnectedness, which is what fear of death is. Fear of death is the fear of loss of disconnectedness for the separate self-perception.
You said loss.
I exactly said that, and I'll repeat it.
Not loss of connectedness?
Loss of disconnectedness. This is for you. Fear of death is the fear of loss of disconnectedness for the separate self-perception. Let's go back. If we are only a set of objects that perceives itself to be separate from other objects, then we're always going to be apprehensive about losing our ground as that set of objects, aren't we? Which actually means, dear Janet, that there's fear of loss of disconnectedness because the separate self object or construction is always disconnected by definition.
Sounds like the separate self needs some serious help.
The separate self construct is getting all the help it could ever need if it could only receive it. That's what needs to shift until it can go, okay, help me. This is what the 12 steps does for folks, the addiction, all the stuff, da, da, da. Get down, and finally there's like this, I can't do it. I can't lift myself out of this. I'm broken. I'm defeated. And St. Francis, if you're not napping, would you say now, this is about not my will, but thine.
So it needs help?
It has the help that it needs within itself. The help that it needs is tucked, hidden inside it, like a pearl inside a rough oyster shell, or like a soft, different tasting center of the onion. It sweetens up a little bit when you get all the way to the core. Have you noticed? Last person I said that to, you know what she said to me? She said, I don't like onions. Okay. Fear of death is the fear of loss of disconnectedness for the separate self-perception. The Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Tibetan Book of the Living and Dying, the world of consciousness that teaches us about the safety and awakening potential of dying is all over the place. If we don't have the dust in our eyes and are ready to see it, it's the opposite of what you've been thinking, Janet. That's how awakening works. It's an inside out, it's a turnaround. Why cling to existence when existence as a separate self object is doomed?
To disconnect.
Huh?
To be disconnected.
Yeah, that's what you get. That's the result. We can have fear of mortality too, can't we? That's the fear of being so-called a mortal being. Like actually fear of being a bunch of objects and interacting with other objects. That's why last group I was with, when I described the two big fears for most human beings are fear of death and fear of public speaking, fellow in the back said, for me, it's fear of public speaking, number one, and fear of death, number two. So the fear of mortality can manifest as fear of emotionality, fear of sexuality, sensuality, yeah, fear of the material world, fear of having things, you know, fear of people giving you things, being nice to you, loving you. You in the sense of an object, right? And you get a little bit of that, I already said this, but you get a little bit of that sense of release from separateness when somebody loves you nice and good. Oh yeah, this is nice. I guess I'm okay. I mean, at least they feel I am. So there's the fear of mortality that we need to work our way through so that we can actually be here in the relative bag of objects embodied. And then the fear of the inherent insubstantiality or the void or the emptiness awaits us. And it's not necessarily, you know, fear of mortality gets all worked out and then the fear of the immortality or the impermanence or the emptiness comes on. Okay, one, finish that, now number two. It can move back and forth. Okay. But sometimes people have a big shift in opening into insubstantiality. And there's elements of the ego project, or the emotional being, or the biographical personality structure that's needing resolution. It needs attention, it needs care, it's fragmented, it's confused, And if a person not careful, they actually can engage in something that's very well researched at this point, and more has come out about this. It's called spiritual bypass, where you have an experience of openness and connectedness, and then you identify with that, and now you've got these parts of your intimate sort of emotional self, if you will, that are really like needing some attention and care. And that can be problematic sometimes. So what we need, really, then, is a thorough, comprehensive, holistic inquiry, so that the ego project, right, the biographical being, is not threatened as it becomes decentralized, and openness and spaciousness and realization of yourself as not an object begins to come. Because it'll act like an anchor sometimes. And I've seen this many times with folks, mostly through therapy, who are also meditating. And they'll have a very lovely experience meditating. And it works very well, and they open up very nicely. And then they get back into relationship with other people, and they go back to their job, and they go back to the stuff that is part of their lay life, so to speak, householder life, and they're having problems again. And there's fear, confusion, anger coming out, these kinds of things. Now, the core negative, self-construction belief is that I'm not enough. It also manifests as I'm not good enough, which can sometimes manifest as I can't do this. I'm inadequate. I'm unworthy. And usually this was transmitted from other beings who also felt that they were not good enough. They were not worthy. And they osmotically gave it to us by how they held us, how they looked at us, how they rejected us. And this is at a time when we were too innocent in the form that we're in to be able to go, you know what? You're having some anxiety today. Now I'd like to keep nursing, but would you please relax? I mean, every now and then, even a preschool kid will look at neurotic adults and just say, would you please stop? And it's amazing. They just pop it out. They probably don't say, would you breathe, breathe out. It's all impermanent. No, they say, stop. And sometimes their angst there, stop. Or they might say, what are you doing? It's a little harder to say, leave me alone. Just leave me alone, okay? Go sit on your cushion for a little bit and come back and put the food on the table and let me eat. Now, I have my story about that. I'm not going to go into it. You may have yours, and you know other people have theirs. You come here, and because you are brought into this world in the temporal sense, the body-mind process, by beings who are wounded themselves, you become wounded. It's part of the nature of coming here. Your parents are not perfectly loving and compassionate and empathic in all situations. And therefore, they transmitted that to you. Now, they may not have intentionally done it, but at other times they may have intentionally done it. It's a little bit different. But it happens. So we have to be, not have to, we get to be, sensitive to that, caring about that, and sometimes we need help. I know I've needed lots of help from other good people to help me with those parts of my life. Yeah. The fragmented separate self. It's not just that the separate self is separate from the wholeness and vastness of life, but it's fragmented within itself. So the biggest core issue then, hidden inside the I'm not good enough, is actually that we've mistaken ourselves, mistaken ourselves, mistake ourselves. If we mistaken ourselves as a set of objects, including the object of awareness, I am the awareness, I turn the awareness into an object, when in fact it's not, I'm always alone. I'm always alone. And I'm disconnected. The separate self construct is always disconnected. We're ambivalent, funny creatures. We really want to know the truth. We want to know the deepest, sublime truth, and yet we're afraid of it. Isn't that interesting? We're afraid to really be ourselves. Afraid sometimes to really tell the truth. Afraid to really open up. Afraid to be free. Afraid to be unified. So there's a core, ultimate core groundlessness of any and all self-constructs, any and all self-identification is fundamentally disconnected and groundless. It has no ground. So we then become resistive, reactive, and fearful of the unknown, and yet we don't even know what the unknown is. Isn't that interesting? It's like the image of painting the tiger in my mind, putting the fangs on it, and it's all the imagination, and then I go, ah! Or it's this, having dissolution happen, and then the fear comes, and then this whole thing just goes through this whole set of actions to try to go, I'm okay, I'm back. I'm back, I'm back. I'm okay. How's it going to work if ultimately there's no control? It's going to work just fine. That's what the Buddha reveals for us with second, third, and fourth noble truth. The cause of suffering is grasping, clinging, from not understanding the nature of things. Third noble truth, there is cessation of all formation. Everything changes, nothing lasts. Everything's dissolving. Fourth noble truth, the way to live your life sanely, rationally, so that you realize the noble truths. You don't just think about them, you realize them experientially. It's so clear. It's the first teaching that he gave after the awakening to his companions who had deserted him when he took some milk from a milkmaid and broke his fast because his buddies were into self-mortification, denial of the flesh, transcendence through abstinence. And he saw that's not the way. And he went alone into his meditation, as the legend has it. How's it going to work if ultimately there's no control? Perfectly fine. Perfectly fine. That's what we're here to see. If we've been abandoned in our life, then the vastness is scary because we perceive it as abandonment. If we've had those who cared for us engulf us, then the vastness will seem like something that eats you up and engulfs you. Whatever you've got in your biographical system that's unresolved, as the vastness comes, it's probably going to come up. That's why this is also psychotherapy as much as it is meditation. Because it brings up the psychological, emotional issues as you open. See that fear that came up and went through the body like that? That wasn't just about dissolution of the body. That was actually about public speaking. It took a while to see that. That was fear of being real and open and talking with other people. It took a while to see that, but that's partly what that fear was about. Now, it came out in an interesting way. It wasn't so direct, but it came out, and eventually I began to realize, oh, wow, that fear that was really magnified that day is a bit like that fear that I've been feeling in here and in here and in here and in here when it's time to talk openly with people. I went all the way back to when I was a little boy in school. And then, of course, the perception that the vastness is unsafe. Oh, yeah, it is. It's absolutely unsafe to the self, it's separate self-construct. That's by design. Because the vastness will take that separate self-construct and it'll say, join us. Join us. You can still even hang around. That's why the personality, however it needs to manifest, it hangs around, it just becomes not the driver of the car. And in fact, it functions better, usually. It's not like, oh, wow, ego transcendence means the ego just... No, the ego just slides over and goes, oh, so I'm not the big cheese after all. Huh. Okay. But I can still come, right? I can be myself. I can be goofy, stupid. I can be this. It still happens. And it's a guarantee that some people will like that and some people won't. That goes on. The reason why they don't like that is because they don't like the ones that's inside of them. That's why they don't like that one. Or your ego project is truly obnoxious. And then everybody shouldn't like it, including you. You need a real Roto-Rooter. You know, just really need it to be turned around, turn the soil over, maybe just start again. Bad start, you know, restart. Totally different download. Change it. Okay. It's a little bit more. So we get a sense here as we're opening that everything, yeah, even as it's changing... Yeah, even as it's changing, everything is open as it is. It's not becoming open, it is open. Which means everything is as it is. This book is open in its bookness. Huh? This body is open in its bodiness. Notice that transcends the perception of, oh, it's contracted right now, so it's not open. That's a perception. Oh, it's contracted right now, so it's not open. Oh, it's not so contracted, so it's open. That's a totally subjective, arbitrary interpretation. The book is open in its bookness. The room is open in its roomness. The trees are open in their treeness. Humans, however they're manifesting, are open in all their expressions, including their closeness. They're open in their closeness. I'm openly closed. I'm being closed. Okay? I'm being closed. Can I be closed? I'm open to that. You see? It's open. Everything's open as it is already. Everything spontaneously, by nature, is that. Which means the truth and the truth that is symbolized are no different. Let me clarify. Everything that is symbolizes the Dharma, the truth of the way things are. The truth of the way things are is actually so simple, so direct, so immediate that we mistake it, we overlook it, we think about it, we step past the very end of our nose, and we look for something more complicated and extraordinary when the ordinariness of the Dharma, that everything that's happening symbolizes the Dharma, the truth of the way things are. This is about simply seeing things without any bias. And when bias is there, simply seeing bias. We're actually capable, believe it or not, in moments at least, of being completely and utterly free from prejudice. In all respects. Because prejudice is bias. And that subtle or not so subtle bias or prejudice separates things, doesn't it? Divides things. That's okay. That's part of the nature of wholeness or completeness or things as they are, is that the separating tendency appears. It's here. Have you noticed? It doesn't have to go away. But its true nature can be seen. And then you're not imprisoned by it. The meditation that we're doing is as ordinary as life itself. It's as ordinary as life itself. It's not about striving to reach goals or getting to higher states. These efforts to get to the goals and to the higher states, it complicates and constricts the free flow of life. The groundless ground of being is not a ground like the feeling of being rooted in the body or the feeling of steadiness on the earth or in the mind, but rather it's an openness amidst all that's happening. An openness that has no fixed center. An openness that has no direction. If you don't mind me quoting dear Bob Dylan again, who happens to be in this area doing a concert the other night, I think it was Friday night, mentioned him on Friday. Is that yesterday? Yeah, yesterday. In order to live outside the law, you have to be honest. He also said, when so many could not understand him, no direction home. No direction home. My goodness. Bob Dylan, the Buddha. The openness with no direction. The openness with no center. The openness with no circumference, no boundary. It's right here. The body's sitting in it. The self or separate self idea is sitting in it. In coming, I have no abode. In leaving, I have no direction. How is it? Ultimately, here I am all the time. The I that's being pointed to in the poem is the groundless ground of being. Here I am all the time. This is not about someone opening or being open to experiences. It's rather an openness where there is nothing to attain or realize. No direction. Home. Because home is all there is. Chinese poet Lin Po said it like this. Humans are afraid to forget their minds, fearing to fall through the void with nothing to stay their fall. They do not know that the void is not really void, but the realm of the real Dharma. Now he put the icing on that cake when the legend has it that he drowned after drunkenly leaning out of a boat to embrace the moon's reflection in the water. What a way to go. Born 701, past 762, 61 years. Good teaching, huh? The real Dharma is complete fulfillment that is empty of division and lack. Disappointment and delusionment is the final outcome of the ego project. Even one's spiritual aspirations must and will be defeated in order for surrender to occur. When I say spiritual aspirations, I mean the conceptualizations in the mind. The aspirations in the mind must be defeated. Defeat always precedes surrender. It needs to be understood directly and experientially that the defeat of the ego project simply means the end of seeking fulfillment through wants and desires. Through self-projections, seeking fulfillment through those things is the defeat. The end of the ego project is the defeat of those projections. The end of seeking fulfillment through wants and desires. When this is clear, the egoic drive loses its punch and it just rests amidst the many blades of grass, whereas before it always needed to stand up and wave its arms. Coleman Barks reads Rumi very well. Coleman Barks said, in order to read Rumi properly, I have to die when I read him. Coleman, I hope you like me on this one. Rumi said it this way. Praise to the emptiness that blanks out existence. Existence. This place made from our love for that emptiness. Yet somehow comes emptiness. This existence goes. Praise to that happening over and over. For years I pulled my own existence out of emptiness. Then one swoop, one swing of the arm, that work is over. Free of who I was, free of pretense, free of dangerous fear, hope, free of mountainous wanting. The here and now mountain is a tiny piece of straw, blown out into emptiness. These words I'm saying so much begin to lose meaning. Existence, emptiness, mountain straw. Words and what they try to say swept out the window, down the slant of the roof. Seventeen syllables that capture a moment of life from nature. The haiku poem. The white butterfly disappears in a sun shaft on the rocky trail. That's it.